It was the power of inducing this mental condition which enabled the Indian when taken captive to withstand every device of torture inflicted by his captors, and to sing his death song under the infliction of fire and this low process of bodily mutilation too horrible for description, and which very few of our race could endure without passing into the frenzy of agony. The Indian is far more reposeful and deliberate than the majority of our race, in both mental and physical movement, unconsciously cultivating this repose, and living a life less artificial than ours. He increased his spiritual power, one sure result of which is that command of mind over body which can lessen physical pain, and as an ultimate possibility banish it altogether. Deliberation of movement, or in plainer English movement of muscle so slow that our mind has time to follow it, gives one time to think in great and small emergencies. But the lack of such training causes unconscious physical action. So confirmed becomes this habit, that the body moves without us aware of it. Awkwardness, lack of address, lack of tact are all due to this lack of command of mind caused by lack of deliberation, or in other words, a trained incapacity for taking time to think or plan the proper thing to do. The terror-stricken person, if the ship seems in sudden danger, runs up and down the deck to no purpose, and this physical action is an exact correspondence of the lifelong condition of his mind whose thought has been ever so darting from one thing to another, just as the whim seized him. The more deliberate person whose mind is trained to take time to think and hold or concentrate its thought, holds himself steady, and so gives himself time to see what may be the opportunities for escape. And these two persons would pick up a pin in a very different manner and with very different mental action and method. To train then for courage is to train for deliberate movement in all things, for that is simply training to mass and hold your force in reserve and let out no more than is needed for the moment. No quality of mind is more needful to success in all undertakings than courage. And by courage I mean not only courage to act but courage to think. In everyday business, thousands dare not think of taking a step which would involve an outlay of money above the average of their expenditure. They are appalled at mention of so large a sum. They will not, out of pure fright, entertain the idea long enough to familiarize themselves with it. Now if they reversed this mental action, and instead of immediately giving way out of lifelong habit to this fright, would take time and allow the thought to rest in their minds instead of driving it out, there would in time come to them ideas concerning ways and means for meeting the additional expense, and thereby making a larger sum of money in the same time it took to make the small sum. For instance, you say to the woman who goes out to wash by the day and has never done anything else, Mrs. A., why don't you start a laundry? You can make a great deal more money in so doing. I start a laundry. Where in the world is the money coming from to start a laundry? Is her reply. Here the woman, instead of entertaining your idea, gives way immediately to fright concerning what seems to her the immense sum required, and following the same unreasoning, headlong, panicky style of thought, sets up in a moment an opposition to your proposition. She dare think only of working for day's wages as she is called upon by those who hire her. And thousands for this reason dare not think, or find it disagreeable for them to think, of getting into some broader, more responsible and more profitable sphere of business, because they bunch at once all its possible difficulties into a mass, and out of mere habit will look only at that awful and imaginary bunch. But Mrs. C., the more deliberate washerwoman, hears your proposition and entertains it. In time she says to herself, why should I not start a laundry? Other people have and have succeeded. She lives in the idea, talks to one and another about it, and finds out how they started. The longer she keeps in this current of thought, the more plainly does she see the ways and means by which other people have set up for themselves. Finally, the idea so grows upon her, that she takes some step toward that end, and then another and another, and so by degrees drifts into the business. A person is cool and collected in face of any great danger, because he has the power of holding his mind to the thing to be done on the instant. Cowardice has no such power, and can see in mind not only the source of danger, but a score of possible results which may or may not happen to him. In battle one man may attend. to his duty with a vivid and by no means agreeable condition of mind as he sees men struck and mangled all about him. But the force or thought he can bring to bear on the performance of his duty is greater in amount than that coming of the realization of the slaughter around him, and commands and holds his body to his post. The man who runs, or would if he had the chance, cannot fix his mind on anything but the fearful possibilities of the moment. In the so-called trivial act of picking up a pin, or threading a needle, or opening a door, I do not argue that all one's force or thought should be placed on the act, but only enough to perform the act well while the rest is kept in reserve. It is in substance the same as in picking up a weight. You would not try to expend the force in lifting 1 pound that you would in lifting 50 pounds. You do expend a great deal more force in the act of picking up a pin when your mind is preoccupied with something else, for you are then trying to do two things or lift two weights at once. You will remember that anything which is done in mind, expends quite as much force as if done with the body, so that the persons who linger abed in the morning and think with dread of the breakfasts to be cooked, or the rooms to be swept, so far as expenditure of force is concerned, will be doing those acts then and there while lying on their backs. In expending just force enough to perform any act, a capacity which will gradually grow upon you as you familiarize yourself with this idea and set your desire or demand upon it, you cultivate and increase continually that desirable state of mind, which in everyday language is known as having your wits about you. That means, in other words, always having, no matter what you are doing, your mental eyes open in every direction, and while outwardly you seem all intent and occupied in the one act, your mind or spirit like a vigilant sentinel is continually on the lookout, so as to give you notice in the fractional part of an instant of all that is going on about you, and also to direct you how to meet the event, whatever it may be. This is not only the characteristic of courage, but of tact and address. It was this electric vigilance and mind watchfulness that gave an American officer during the Revolution, who, in the confusion of battle, suddenly found himself in front of a British regiment, the deliberation to ask, "What troops are these?" "The Royal Scots," was the reply. "Royal Scots remain as you are," was his answer, and he rode off to his own lines. That man had a mind trained to give him time to think. On one occasion, Mrs. Farren, the celebrated English actress, discovered where her part required her to hem a handkerchief that the property man had forgotten to lay out the handkerchief needle, thread, etc. Without a moment's hesitation she sat down and imitated so naturally the motion and manner of a lady in sewing that most of her audience never suspected the omission. That act involved self-possession, coolness, deliberation, presence of mind, courage. Do not all these terms imply a similar state of mind? A woman habitually hurried and flurried could not have done this, and I believed that when Mrs. Farren saw proper to pick up a pin, she did so in a much more deliberate manner than would a habitually hurried, flurried man or woman. Cultivate deliberate act and movement in all things, and you lay more and more the solid foundation for courage, either moral or physical. But deliberate act does not always imply slowness. Just as thought moves with electric rapidity, so may it move the body when occasion requires, but the thought must be clearly planned, seen and outlined in mind before it is allowed to act on the body. It is so seen or planned, and so acts to use the muscles in the rapid thrust and parry of the skilled fencer, and similarly with the professional danseuse, in fact in all superior accomplishments, be they of painter, musician or other artist. These, however, in many cases, are but partial controls of mind. Outside of his art, the artist may have little mental control or deliberation, and as a result be nervous, vacillating, easily disturbed, whimsical and timid. The mind is our garrison to be armed at all points and disciplines to meet any emergency. We deal with the making, or self-making, of whole men and women, whose minds are not cultivated all in one direction and neglected everywhere else. It is far better in the end to be growing symmetrically and to be finished so far as we have grown all around, than to have our power all concentrated on one talent or capacity, and becoming what the world calls a genius. The inside history of genius is often a sad one, and shows that it brought little happiness to its possessor. Scores and hundreds of the little acts of everyday life, such as picking dropped articles from the floor, opening and shutting drawers, laying or reaching for articles on the toilet table, and attending to minor details of dress, are done unconsciously in this hurried condition of mind, especially when some more important object engages our attention. We snatch, we clutch, we drive recklessly about in the doing of these things, and we weaken our bodies and become tired out, and finally panicky, and easily frightened through this mental habit, for fear and cowardice slip in far more easily when the body is weak. This habit cannot be changed in a day or a year when it has pervaded a lifetime. Neither can the ills, mental and physical, resulting from such habit, be cured immediately. There can be only gradual growth away from them. If in reading this you feel convinced that there is something in it, and feel also a conviction that some portion of it suits your own case, your cure has then commenced. Real conviction. The conviction that comes from within, never leaves one or stops working to get us out of the evil way and put us in the good one. It may seem buried and forgotten for seasons, and our erroneous habits may seem growing stronger than ever. That is not so. But as convictions take root, we are seeing our errors more and more clearly. We forget that at one time we were blind and did not see them at all. If this book brings to you a conviction of a long-established error, it is not I individually who bring or convince. It is only that I put out more or less of a truth, which takes hold of you and the cord of truth in you senses it. If I apply the torch to the gas jet and light it, it does not follow that I make either the fire or the gas. I am only a means or agent for lighting that gas. No man makes or invents a truth. Truth is as general and widely spread and belongs to every individual as much as the air we breathe, and there is pleasure enough in being its torchbearer without presuming to claim the power of its creator. Above all, demand more and more courage of the supreme power. Chapter 5. Look forward. The tendency with many people after they are a little advanced in years is to look backward and with regret. The looking should be the other way forward. If you want to go backward in every sense, mental and physical, keep on cultivating the mood of living regretfully in your past life. It is one chief characteristic of the material mind to hold tenaciously to the past. It likes to recall the past and mourn over it. The material mind has a never-ending series of solemn amusement, in recalling past joys, and feeling sad because they are never to come again. But the real self, the spirit, cares relatively little for its past. It courts change. Too expects to be a different individual in thought a year hence from that it is today. It is willing 1,000 years hence to forget who or what it is today, for it knows that this intense desire to remember itself for what it has been retards its advance toward greater power and greater pleasure. What care you for what you were 1,000 or 5,000 years ago? Yet then you were something, and something far less than what you are today. You are curious, you may answer to know what you were. Yes, but is curiosity worth gratifying, if for such gratification you must pay the price of dragging after you 100 corpses of your dead selves? Those selves, those existences, have done their work for you. In doing that work they brought you possibly more pain than pleasure. Do you want ever to bear with you the memory and burden of that pain? Especially when such burden brings more pain and deprives you of pleasure. It is like the bird that should insist on carrying with it always the shell from which it was hatched. If you have a sad remembrance, fling it off. If you can't fling it off, demand of the supreme power aid to help you do so, and such aid will come. If you want to grow old, feeble, grey and withered, go at once and live in your past, and regret your youth. Go and to revisit places and houses where you lived 20, 30, 40 years ago, call back the dead, mourn over them, live in remembrance over the joys you had there, and say they are gone and fled and will never come again. In so doing you are fastening dead selves all over you. If we came into another physical life with the memory of the last one, we should come into the world physically as miniature, decrepit, grizzled old men and women. Youth physically is fresh and blooming, because it packs no past sad material remembrances with it. A girl is beautiful because her spirit has flung off the past and sad remembrance of its previous life, and has therefore a chance for a period to assert itself. A woman commences to age, then she commences to load up with regrets over a past but 20 years gone. Your spirit demands for the body it uses grace, agility of movement and personal beauty, for it is made in the image of God, and the infinite mind and life. Beauty, grace and agility are the characteristics of that mind. In that phase of existence we called childhood and youth, the spirit has the chance to assert its desire for beauty and agility, because it has not as yet loaded up with false beliefs and regrets. The liveliness, sprightliness and untiring playfulness of the boy or girl of 10 or 12, is due to the gladness of spirit relieved of the burden that is carried in a past existence. That burden was one of thoughts unprofitable to carry. You would physically have the agility you had at 15 could you fling off the burden of sad remembrance and belief in error that you have been loading up with these 20 or 30 years past. You can commence the unloading process now, by resolving, with the aid of the supreme power, to fling off the remembrance of everything in the past that has annoyed you, everything you regret, everything you have mourned over. God never mourns or regrets. You as a spirit are made in His image. God is eternal life, joy and serenity. The more of these characteristics you reflect, the nearer are you to the infinite spirit of good. Have you buried your dearest on earth? You do them no good by your sad thoughts concerning them. You place betwixt their spirit and yours in thinking of them as lost. You may in so doing not only increase and encourage in them a sad mental condition, but bring their gloomy mental condition on yourself, as many do in grieving. The greatest good we can do them is to think of them as alive like ourselves, and to fling their graves, tombstones, coffins, shrouds and ghastliness out of our minds. If we cannot do so of ourselves, let us demand help of the supreme power to do it. We often make those who have lost their bodies feel dead when we think of them as such. If we do this, they will throw back their thoughts of deadness on us. Keep out of graveyards. It may seem to some that I am cold and unfeeling to say thus, but the truth, as it presents itself to me, says that the graveyard where your loved ones do not lie, is spiritually a most unhealthy place to visit. They are full of the thought of regret, death and decay. When you visit them, you incorporate such thought into yourself. It is hostile and killing to youth, vigor, elasticity, cheerfulness and life. Our graveyards are full of lies. We place a stone over the cast-off body of a friend. We place on that stone the word died. That is not true. Your friend is not dead. It is only the body he used that lies there. But that grave is planted in your memory, and your friend in your mind lies in it. Do what we will, try to believe what we may of the eternal prolongation of life and the impossibility of anything like death in the universe, we cannot help making for ourselves when we think of that grave or revisit it, an image of that friend as dead and decaying in his or her coffin. This image we fasten in our minds, and in so doing we fasten on ourselves the thought of gloom, death and decay. The thoughts of decay and death are things and forces. When we keep them so much in mind, we add elements of decay to the body. We need as much as possible to fasten our thought on life and increasing life, life greater in its activity than any we have ever realized. That is not gained by looking backward. Look forward. Every regret, every mournful thought, takes so much out of your life. It is force used to pile on more misery. It is force used to strengthen the habit of regretting. It is force used to make the mind color everything with a tinge of sadness, and the longer you use force in this way, the darker will grow the tinge. Also, when we are ever going back in memory to the past and living in it in preference to the present, we are bringing back on ourselves the old moods of mind and mental conditions belonging to that past. This feeling constantly indulged in will bring on some form of physical ailment. The ailment belongs to a condition of mind which we should be done with forever. If we are looking forward, we shall shake it off and be better in health than ever. If the predominant mood of our minds is that of looking backward, the ultimate result will be serious to the body. In the world's business you're active, enterprising, pushing man of affairs spends little time in sad reminiscence. If he did, his business would suffer. His thought is forward. That thought is the real force which pushes his business forward. If he spent it in sad memories of the past, his business would go backward. He works his success, so far as he does really succeed, by this spiritual law, though he may not know it. You may be saying, I have failed in life and shall always be a failure. That is because you are ever leaking back, living in your failure and thereby bringing to you more failure. Reverse this attitude of mind, work it the other way and live in future success. Why do you say, I am always sick? Because you are looking back, living in your past ailments and thereby bringing more on you. I have heard the expression used, when the earth was young. As if this planet was now in its dotage and going to decay. In the sense of freshness, increase of life, refinement and purity in every form of life, be that of man, animal, vegetable, and farther on, this earth never was so young as it is today. Youth is life, growing and increasing in beauty and power. It is not the cruder commencement of life. The so-called barren rock contains elements which will help to form the future tree and flower. Is that part of the rock which enters into tree and flower increasing or decreasing in life? It changes only into a higher and more beautiful expression of life. So do we from age to age. The rock crumbles that it may live in this higher form. The old mind must crumble and pass away to give place to the new, and make of us the newer spiritual being. As the old mind crumbles, so will the old body, for the spiritual change must be accompanied by the physical change. But if you live in the understanding and spirit of this law, you need not lose a physical body, but have one ever changing for the better. As you live in spiritual belief, as the old life goes out, the new comes in. Nothing in nature, nothing in the universe is at a standstill. Nothing goes backward. A gigantic incomprehensible force and wisdom moves all things forward toward greater and higher powers and possibilities. You are included in and are a part of this force. There is of you in embryo the power of preventing the physical body your spirit uses from decaying, and the power also of using it in ways which even the fiction of today would discard as too wild for the pages of the novel. For your spirit youth and ever-growing youth is an eternal heritage. If your body has aged, that is no sign that your spirit has aged. The spirit cannot grow old in the material sense, any more than the sunlight can grow old. If your body has aged, it is because that body has become the material likeness and expression of a false self or shell which has formed on your spirit. That false self is made up of thoughts prevalent around from an early physical age, and those thoughts are untrue thoughts. A large proportion of that thought is regret. Regret is an inverted force, a turning of the mind to look backward when its natural and healthy state is to look forward, and live in the joys that are certain to come when we do look forward. In the new life to come to our race, when we have learned to be ever looking forward to the greater joys to come and cease to look backward and drag the dead past with us, men and women are to have bodies far more beautiful and graceful than those of today. Because their bodies will image or reflect their thoughts, and their thoughts will ever be fixed on what is beautiful and symmetrical. They will know that what is to come and what is in store for them out of the richness of the infinite mind must exceed anything they have realized in the past. Today, with the great majority of people, their attitude of mind is directly the reverse. Owing to the little trust that they have in that power the theologian calls God, they are ever in their mind saying, there are no joys to come for us like our past joys. Our youth has fled. Our future on earth is tame and dull. It is as dust and ashes. The truth that life does not end with the death of the body makes slow progress in fixing itself firmly in our minds. The kind of life a man may be living here at 70 does not end in the grave. It continues straight on. The old man, as we call him here, wakes up in the other side of life after losing his body an old man still. If he is one of those old men who have outlived their day and generation, who live in their physical past and look back on it with regret, who have become too old to learn, and think they have got through with it all, he will be just such an old man in the world of spirit. There is no sudden transformation into youth on the death of a worn-out, decrepit body. As the tree falls, so does it lie for a period, even in the hereafter. But in this state he cannot stay forever. He must grow not in age but youth. To do this it is necessary not only that he should leave the old body but the old material mind that made that body. His spirit throws off that mind when he gains a new body, or is reincarnated, and he throws it off because he loses the recollection of all past sad memories and regrets. The man should in mind be always the boy, the woman, the girl. You can as man or woman be always boy or girl in spirit without being silly or losing real dignity. You can have all the playfulness of youth with the wisdom of maturity. To have a clear powerful mind you need not be an owl. There may be for a period a certain use for us in going back to our more recent past lives, and for a time living in them. Sometimes we are pushed back temporarily into some old condition of mind, some old experience in order to make us more alive than ever to the rags and tatters of errors in belief still clinging to us. This may come of revisiting places and people from whom we have long been separated. For a time during such visit old associations, the moods connected with them and possibly old habits we thought long since cast off, resume their sway. We may become for a time absorbed and swallowed up in the old life. We resume temporarily an old mind or mental condition that was formerly our permanent one in that place or association. But after a little the new mind, the new self into which we have grown during the long absence, antagonizes the old. It feels aversion and disgust for the narrow life, the false beliefs and the dull, monotonous, purposeless lives about it. It, the spirit, refuses to have anything to do with the old. Then comes a conflict between our two minds, the old and the new, which may result in temporary physical sickness. Our old life or self rises as it were out of its grave and tries to fasten itself on the new and even rule the new. The new self rejects the corpse with horror. But through thus seeing the corpse, it sees also fragments of the old self which, unperceived, have all along been adhering to the new. We do not get rid of error in belief all at once, and often unconsciously retain shreds of such belief when we imagine ourselves entirely rid of them. These shreds are the remains of old thoughts and former mental conditions. Your new mind so awakened arises and pushes off what it finds left on it of the old. This pushing off is accompanied by physical disturbance. Because your spirit puts all its force in rejecting these fragments of the former self, as you might put all your physical strength in pushing off a snake. Our old errors in belief must be so pushed off before the new thoughts, which come in as the old go out, can have full sway. If your spirit was contentedly and blindly carrying any scorpion of false belief, you would tumble into the pit eventually as so many are now doing. When you live several years in any certain house or town or locality, you make a spiritual self belonging to that locality. Every house, tree, road or other object you have long been in the habit of seeing there, has a part of that self in thought attached to it. Every person who knows you there has in his or her mind the self you make there, and puts that self out then they meet you or talk of you. If you had years before in that place, the reputation of being weak, or vacillating, or impractical, or intemperate, and you return to the people who knew you as such, although you may have changed for the better, you are very liable in their thought and recollection of you to have this old self pushed back on you, and as a result, you may for a period feel much like your former self. You return to such place after a long absence. You have during that absence changed radically in belief. You bring with you a different mind. You are in reality a different person. But the old you, the old self of former years will rise from every familiar object to meet you. It will come out of houses formerly inhabited by your friends, though now tenanted by strangers. You will find it in the village church, the old schoolhouse, the very rails and fence posts familiar to you long years before. More than all, it will come out of the recollection of people who only knew you for what you were, say 20 years before. Every such person strengthens with you this image of your former self. You talk with them on the plane of the previous life or self. For the time being you ignore yourself as it now thinks and believes, you put aside your newer self, not wishing to obtrude on your friend's opinions, which to them may be unpleasant, or seem wild and visionary. You meet perhaps 25 or 30 people who know you only as your former self, and with all these you act out the old self, and repress the new. This for a time makes the old dead self very strong, but you cannot keep this up, you cannot warm the old corpse of yourself into life.